Hey, sex fans, welcome back. Today is Wednesday, August 14th, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge. And I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick.
I'm scared of walking out of this room and never feeling the rest of my whole life the way I feel when I'm with you.
You need to take a chill pill, girl. Listen, I'm delighted to continue the Sex Wisdom series today. After the last 2 weeks of chat with an up-and-coming therapist who is just beginning her sexological career, I am proud to welcome a woman of distinction in our field. My guest today is cultural anthropologist and sex researcher and noted author, Catherine Frank. Catherine has distinguished herself as one who can tackle some of the thorniest issues of human sexual behavior with objectivity and compassion. Her 3 books, as well as her numerous academic papers and popular articles, provide us with an intelligent and intimate view of the sexual fringe. And she's here today to tell us about her research and why she chooses to study what she does.
You use your tongue prettier than a $20 whore.
That's good to know. Catherine invites you to visit her on her site, cleverly named katefrank.com. And through her site, you'll be able to buy all her books. However, for your convenience, there will be links to her books in today's podcast posting on drdicksexadvice.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by the ideal sponsor for this edgy series, Dr. Dick's Stockroom. You'll find this treasure trove of sexually stimulating toys, implements, and fetish wear and gear right on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the Dr. Dick's Stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site. You'll surely love shopping at Dr. Dick's Stockroom because it's just so damn fun and, I might add, easy. Yes, sex fans, you can spare yourself the embarrassment of skulking down to your local sex emporium to pick up all those nasty toys you've been drooling over. You can forget about seedy storefronts in unsavory neighborhoods, and you don't have to worry about leering salesmen scrutinizing what you buy. Why? Because you shop from the privacy of your own computer. That's why.
I want to roll you into a little ball and shove you up my vagina.
Won't that be special for us both? Thanks to Dr. Dick's Stockroom, it's never been easier or more discreet to be a big fat pervert. Be sure to take a moment out of your hectic schedule and visit my stockroom today. You'll be so glad you did. Okay, on with the show. Welcome, Catherine, and thank you for joining us for this Sex Wisdom show. And now that you're here, would you like to say hello to all the really nice people?
Hello, thanks for listening.
Oh, good, good, good. This may come as a surprise to you, but there's probably a big load of perverts in our audience, too. That's just the nature of things. I consider myself part of that group, so maybe you want to say hello to those folks as well.
Oh, I don't make distinctions. I think everyone has to put a pleasure to them. So.
Yay! I do, too. Yeah. I just want to say that I thank my lucky stars that I ran into you on LinkedIn. I had just connected with a colleague that I hadn't seen for like ever, and then LinkedIn shuffled me off to one of their other pages full of people they thought I might know. I saw your mugshot on the site, and that immediately caught my eye. Holy cow, what a knockout. And then I read that you were a cultural anthropologist, author, and sex researcher, and I was totally smitten. You are some kind of wonderful, don't you know?
That's so sweet. Thank you.
So I couldn't wait to pitch you on joining me for the show. You know, my audience depends on me to bring them the most interesting folks that I can find, and you, Dr. Frank, are one such person. So let's get right down to it, shall we? Here's what your LinkedIn profile says about you. Catherine Frank is a cultural anthropologist, PhD from Duke University, and sex researcher. She is the author of Plays Well in Groups, A Journey Through the World of Group Sex, and G-String and Sympathy, which I absolutely love the name, Strip Club Regulars and Male Desire, and the co-author of Flesh for Fantasy, Producing and Consuming Erotic Dance.
How did you make the leap from cultural anthropology to sex research? And why did you make that leap?
No, it wasn't really a leap because I think my interest in sexual behavior was sort of there all along.
Uh-huh.
Cultural anthropology is more how I study
than necessarily
what I study. So I'm really interested in people's the meanings that people give to their behavior and their motivations and how they understand their experiences. So I'm not interested in, you know, counting how many times people have sex in different positions or anything like that. But I really want to understand why they have sex and what it means to them when they do. And no matter what I study, I was also, you know, I've written on a lot of different topics, but
the method
that I use is often, you know, one of the hallmarks of cultural anthropology. I like to really immerse myself in whatever I'm studying. I like to use participant observation, interviewing, sometimes multiple in-depth interviewing, and just sort of get inside people's heads.
Right. So I'm of the mind that it's hard to consider human behavior, particularly from a cultural perspective, without being mindful of sexuality. I mean, so much of what drives culture in any age, it seems to me, is sex. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that culture also shapes sex. So
right.
Intertwined. So there are ultimately biological and physiological aspects of sexuality and sexual desire, but how it plays out in each context is very much social.
Uh-huh.
So why will guys in the U.S. spend money to look at strippers without actually having sex with them?
Mm-hmm.
They do. But why would other guys from around the world laugh at spending money on strippers instead of hookers or actually spending their money on an orgasm, right? Part of what I explored in my latest book on the group sex is this interplay of sexual desire and arousal and practice in specific cultural contexts.
Mm-hmm.
So I think every culture surrounds sex with their own specific meanings and taboos. So, you know, where and when you can have it. Can you have sex before a football game or during a full moon or if a woman is menstruating?
Right.
Who can you have it with, right? What partners are acceptable or not? How often can you have it? What does it mean when you have it? So I'm fascinated by that interplay.
I am too. So we're going to get to your books in depth in a bit, right now I'd like to continue a little bit with what your LinkedIn page says. Frank has published in numerous peer-reviewed journals, The Archives of Sex Research, Deviant Behavior, Journal of Sex Research, Qualitative Inquiry, and Sexualities, for example, and her writing on strip clubs, marriage and monogamy, infidelity, reality television, swinging, sex tourism, eating disorders, and feminism appears in numerous anthologies. She has also published short fiction and nonfiction in magazines ranging from the prestigious Harvard Business Review to Spread magazine, which is a publication for and by sex workers. See, this is what I mean. You're so prolific. It's like you're an industry all to yourself. When do you find time to touch yourself impurely?
Well, I'm also a mom, so I definitely don't have time for that.
Yikes. Holy cow. That's absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. So you have such diverse interests, reality TV to sex work and monogamy to eating disorders. That's quite a span. I suppose that you see a lot of connectivity between all of these interests, more so than those of us who may not be paying as close attention to this as you are.
Well, I think that the underlying connection between all my interests is just that they're truly mine. I've always had difficulty studying what people thought I should study or sticking the more prestigious topics in a discipline. I tend to study issues that mean a lot to me personally, and that's what keeps me going. I'm also really interested in why people follow rules and norms, whatever those rules and norms may be in their cultural milieu.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are sometimes places where those rule breakers and the rules are clashing, right? So sex work, monogamy, different, you know, alternative sexualities, those, I guess they're connected by being sort of at the edges sometimes.
Right.
So.
So do you suppose if we did pay closer attention to the dovetailing of all of this stuff that is going on in the popular culture, we might see some pretty amazing unifying principles?
Well, you know, I've been studying sex for a long time, and I've really come to believe that it doesn't have any type of ultimate meaning across time and place. Sexual practices unfold in a context, so you could have, say, gay men having bareback sex at a football game they met on Grindr, right, using an app. Or you can have men in Papua New Guinea who having anal sex with each other during a group experience that includes one woman and multiple men, called Lineup. I write about that in the book a bit. And so in both contexts, you could say there are men having sex with men without condoms, right?
Right.
But the meanings of each experience in each of those different contexts are so different.
Right.
So it doesn't, there's no ultimate or kind of unifying meaning, although the one unifying thing is that sex will become meaningful and it will stay that way. So, you know, even though we might think differently about a sexual experience we've had, you know, when we reflect upon it, we may think it was good or it was bad and then change our minds later, right? It doesn't even have a stable personal meaning.
Nice.
But sex will remain meaningful for humans because it involves the boundaries of the body and the boundaries of the self. So across time and place, regardless of what those specific meanings are, sex is the perfect material for which people can sort of wrap all these different layers around.
Then it seems to me that, you know, people in a particular culture like ours, for example, oftentimes read a lot into sexual expression or a sexual behavior, that not only, you know, judgmental things like this is good and this is bad behavior, or this is permitted and this is prohibited, but also, you know, a lot of people, read love into it, read pleasure into it, when those things are not necessarily present.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things it's hard to generalize, but I'm going to generalize because it makes the interview more fun. So, you know, hopefully take the generalizations with a grain of salt. But, you know, I would say that you find that everywhere, right? Again,
right.
Because sex is really calling into question the boundaries of our own bodies, the fluids, the orifices of the body, and then of the self, because even as we're a child learning about ourselves, where we start, where someone else starts, you know, those orifices and the things that we do with our mouths and with our genitals are made very important, right?
Right.
Discuss shame and guilt come into play here quite a bit, and whenever these boundaries are crossed, they, you know, you have a jolt. Different cultures will teach differently, right?
Right.
And different parents will teach, you know,
right,
behave differently in terms of those boundary crossings. But because they're so significant, and they're so significant, I truly believe they are universally significant, that, you know, sex becomes itself easily sort of deployed in rituals or religious beliefs and prohibitions and identity formation and politics and all these different realms. So, yeah, was I answering the question?
Yeah. That was brilliant. I loved it.
Okay.
So being a good researcher is dependent not only on being observant, but being able to be dispassionate about what you observe. My guess is that most of us can do the observing part pretty well, to one degree or another anyhow, but very few of us can do the dispassionate thing. How do you do it?
Well, I guess I don't think being dispassionate is necessarily a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
I could, you know, study chemical polymers or aeronautics or something, but why would I want to dedicate my life to something I'm not passionately curious about? And I really, the amount of work that I do each time that I take up a new project, it's pretty intense. So if I didn't have that passion, I don't think I would ever finish my projects. But that being said, I do think that being honest to yourself and to others is extremely important, especially when one studies humans. So being reflexive is absolutely necessary to be a researcher, to be a responsible researcher. You know, with sex, for example, researchers can be triggered by what they discover in the field, by what they observe. And so it's important to look at the assumptions that you hold and the reasons that you think the way you do, and then figure out how those assumptions affect your data collection and analysis, because they probably do. Mm-hmm. And when that process is made more transparent for readers and people who are evaluating it, other people can, you know, they can take those things into account when they're reading both, you know, your analysis and thinking about how you collected your data. I think most problems arise when people don't realize how their beliefs and emotions are affecting their projects. And I can give an example from my first project on the men who visited strip clubs. You know, I think there's a belief that there could be, you know, sort of unbiased interview position or something of that sort. But really, people are always responding to who you are. So I noticed during my interviews that when the customers saw me and they saw me wearing a wedding ring, they would say, "What does your husband think of this?" They were reacting to me, a grad student married stripper, right? And there were good things and bad things about it, but it was important that my readers knew who I was. But the other part of that is that then I started thinking about that question and how many times I got it, and I started turning it back on them. And I said, "Well, what does your wife think about you going to the clubs?" It wasn't a question that had been asked in the literature before, and it was a unique question that came out of my interaction with my interviewees, you know? And that became very productive for me. So I had to deal with my own emotions, where I was perfectly happy being a dancer, but I was really uncomfortable when I contemplated the wives at home who were unhappy, right? I was also being triggered by my own beliefs, because at that time I believed in monogamy. I wanted to have a monogamous marriage, and I couldn't help in the back of my mind thinking, well, what if my husband did this, right? So at any rate...
And weren't you the agent for the, you know, in quotes, infidelity?
Right. So that brought up emotions, and but I think in working through those emotions, I was able to contribute something unique to the field. So I think, you know, true objectivity is somewhat illusory, and everything you see depends on your own perspective, your history, your beliefs. And, you know, scientists working in the hard sciences, physics or biology, they're well aware of that fact.
Right.
But I think sometimes people want social science to produce knowledge that's not situational. But I think that, you know, if we get rid of that fantasy, we can be reflexive, and we can still evaluate work. I think there's better research, you know, and part of that is, you know, being reflexive and understanding your own emotions, and part of it is how you design the study, how you collect your data, how you interact with your hypotheses so you allow yourself to be wrong or challenged.
Is that why you take such an immersive kind of approach? I mean, by putting yourself in the situation as opposed to, you know, being perhaps a casual observer or, you know, a studied observer, perhaps?
Well, in this last project, I used all kinds of different methods. I certainly wasn't a participant or even collecting original data in many of these different sites that I looked at. So it was sort of compiling other people's research. And I mean, I really think that how every method has its usefulness, you know? And I think that what our questions are should guide what methods we use. So when I am interested in meaning, yeah, I try to immerse myself as much as possible. And I also find that I'm always kind of a researcher, no matter where I am. I have to be the best party in the world. I'm looking around and analyzing it, and it's a curse in some way. I'm probably more of a researcher than a participant in every sphere of my life in some sense, you know.
That's interesting, yeah.
But I think, you know, there's some questions that can't be answered by that. There are some questions that are truly need a quantitative method to answer. And so it's good to be not biased against a particular method or emotional about which ones you choose.
Right. Very cool. So do you suppose that, you know, we'd all be better off if we were encouraged to slow down and collect data and examine the data and then try to rationally come up with a hypothesis about what we are examining. I mean, even, you know, it's, you know, walking down the aisle of a grocery store or a supermarket and or, you know, thinking about somebody's sex life, it's basically the same kind of thing. There seems to be so much pressure in the popular culture to just have knee-jerk responses to some kind of visual, for example, you know, on the package of a product in the supermarket, or, you know, somebody stampeding us and saying, you know, traditional marriage is the only marriage and gay marriage is going to corrupt, you know, the world.
Right. Well, yeah, I think there's a couple things that come into play that make it difficult for, you know, in our everyday lives to really be able to think critically about every issue we encounter. You know, a lot of us are strapped for time,
right,
researchers included, right?
Right,
and,
right.
Some of those tendencies to polarize and leap to conclusions about things are being human. They're part of the way we think. And we need to make generalizations and move forward, right? So this is why people need to learn critical thinking. It's something that has to be taught, usually. But, you know, when people have direct experience with something, they're more likely to see all the shades of gray involved.
Right,
So unfortunately, you see the knee-jerk polarizing responses a lot when we're talking about the kind of sex or anything, really, that falls outside of most people's everyday experiences. So the media presentations don't help this problem, because a debate with two sides is considered more entertaining than a real dialogue, right? complexity doesn't fit into 5-minute sound bites.
Right. So. And there are these really powerful entities in our society, politics, economics, and religion, three big ones that come to mind, and they're all generating this, you know, polarization, you know, that there's only one way of looking at things, and, you know, you do it this way if you want to be successful, or if you want to be, you know, happy, or if you want God to love you.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. I mean, I think the issues that I was talking about a moment ago about, you know, the lack of time and coming to quick judgments, you know, the issues compounded by the fact that sex triggers people, right? It brings up our unconscious fears and desires,
right,
and wounds, and it gets entangled with shameful or guilty emotions as well as positive ones. And then it also can become shrouded in secrecy, right? Even if you can talk about sex, there's some parts of it you're not supposed to talk about. So, you know, all these things sort of work together, but it's not just our society, if we're talking about U.S., right?
Right.
Some places may be more negative towards certain sexual behaviors or identities than others, or sex in general. But, you know, there's nowhere that I've found that's completely accepting, right? Or that doesn't have, you know, that doesn't sort of wrap sexuality in judgments of good or bad.
Right.
And again, I think this really has to do with the social emotions and how those sort of work in our comparisons of ourselves with other people. So even in alternative sexual enclaves, you know, you find that there are right things to do and things that everyone will freak out if you do. So I've started to stay away. I've started to sort of leave behind the distinction between sex negative and sex positive spaces or societies, because I find that, gosh, both positive and negative kind of flow through.
Absolutely.
Everywhere, yeah.
So have you been on the receiving end of, you know, criticism for the work that you've done? Because, you know, it appears that it steps on a lot of people's toes. It brings to the fore, particularly questions about group sex and sex work, that really pushes a lot of people's buttons. And it just seems to me that there are so many powerful entities, as we just were talking about, lined up to make that an unappealing kind of discussion to have. So people said, you know, the very fact that you're studying this, you give it legitimacy.
Well, I mean, that's my hope. This group sex book just came out, so I haven't had too many responses to it yet. I imagine that there may be, but I also really hope that because I work really hard to do careful scholarship, and I think that, and it's important to me to try to present a picture that's, it's not like I'm trying to write for a particularly liberal audience versus the conservative audience. You know, I would hope that someone who was really religious could also read my work and see that, you know, I don't think that the church, for example, is the only place where, you know, some negative beliefs about society come in. I actually think that the church gives deep meaning to sexuality in a lot of cases,
it can.
Right?
So it certainly can.
They are saying some partners or some practices may be off limits, but they're giving it very deep meaning, and that meaning is different from some of these other enclaves that sort of start battling each other, right? And so my interest isn't really in trying to take sides of any sort. I may have my personal preferences, but I'm saying in my research, I'm trying not to take sides like that, but trying to say everyone's working with this same tendency to privilege certain types of sexualities and, you know, downplay others.
Right.
If we understand how we're all thinking, maybe we can find more common ground.
Right. The reason that I ask that is that my doctoral thesis was about the sexual attitudes and behaviors of gay Catholic priests in the active ministry back in 1981, and that was long before there was such a thing as gay priests.
Yeah.
And so I was, you know, the gay priest for the longest time, like if I was the only one. And everything within the Catholic Church, I was a priest myself, and everything in the Catholic Church rallied to, you know, undercut and my research and vilify me, and it was, in fact, I lost my priesthood over the whole thing. So it was difficult, you know.
Yeah.
And all I was trying to do is bring to the fore this very interesting thing that, you know, heretofore had been, you know, among the missing that nobody wanted to talk about. And I thought it was going to, you know, provide an opportunity for the church to move forward in terms of its sexual ethics. The messenger got killed instead.
Yeah, I think there's probably some settings that are much more difficult than others. You know, when I was writing this, I was completely even out. I mean, I'm affiliated with the university, but I'm not in a tenure track position. I'm not worried necessarily about those same kinds of things, and certainly like working within the Catholic Church and trying to do something that huge, I can only imagine.
Yes, Ralph. I fought them for 13 years trying to save my priesthood and ministry, but it was a fait accompli from day one. Anyhow, so let's move on and talk a little bit about your this new book that you have just coming out, Plays Well in Groups, A Journey Through the World of Group Sex. How did you hit upon group sex? Does this behavior get at some of the fundamentals about us humans and our sexual desires and behaviors?
I think so. I mean, as I said before, I like, you know, kind of the edges of behavior. I like the edges of disciplines, and I like doing interdisciplinary work, and sex is biological, physiological, psychological, cultural. You know, it has all these different elements coming together. Now, I think there is a tendency to reduce sex and sexual desires to arguments about the reproduction of the species. And, you know, I could argue that it's more complicated than that, but a lot of times those arguments just cycle around when you're talking about dyadic sex.
Mm-hmm.
With group sex, you really can't reduce it at all.
Sure.
There's no way around the fact that more is going on than needs to be going on for our species, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not horseshoe crabs who, you know, they cling to each other and have sex in groups, technically. And it's to fertilize these eggs that the female's laid outside her body, right? But when humans have sex in groups, they're doing it for a social reason. I liked it as a topic because I felt like it was really an opportunity to ponder these questions that I've wanted to ponder forever.
Right. And unlike people who might enjoy multiple partners serially, like those in polyamorous relationships, folks who engage in group sex are enjoying multiple partners too, but all at the same time. And so that changes the dynamic, considerably, I'm guessing.
Yeah, people who have group sex, they're breaking a lot of rules. They're breaking them all.
Yes, really.
And they're doing it with witnesses, right?
Right.
So there's, you know, there are taboos against public nudity, against multiple partners, against sex in public. It's not always technically public, like in a public space, but it's not, you know, just
the
two people.
The privacy of your bedroom, right? Right, exactly.
So group sex is different from dyadic sex because everyone's potentially both a witness and being witnessed in transgressive behavior. Even in enclaves where that behavior is accepted, say, you know, a gay bathhouse or a swinger sex club, you know, it's still that behavior is meaningful in the context of a broader society that doesn't necessarily condone it.
And at the same time, it's not a no holds barred kind of thing. There are, you know, rigorous, you know, at least in terms of gay bathhouses, there are rigorous in do's and don'ts and
yes,
ways of behaving that, you know, one has to pick up because, you know, and follow the social cues and things like that. And if you transgress them, even if you don't know what they are, there's hell to pay.
Yes, definitely. In fact, the whole first part of the book is first looking at the mythology of the orgy in Western culture, right? That once people have group sex, they're going to become animals and run screaming through the woods with, you know, eating raw snakes and, you know.
And that only happens once or twice, and then it's over.
Usually when someone's throwing a party, you know, with that theme, right? It's the myths about what happens to people who have group sex and what's going to happen to culture if it's allowed to happen. They're numerous and fascinating.
Right, right.
When the reality is, it's very orderly.
Yes.
It's down to what you can wear, how you ask for to join in, you know, who's allowed, what the rules are, how long you could have sex, how you, you know, stop. So that part of the book was really fun, and I tried to get, you know, accounts from sex clubs all over the world, right, where there were slightly different rules, but there was always rules.
Right.
Even in a gang rape, which was, you know, I ended up writing a lot more about violence than I thought I would, but gang rape is a particular kind of group sex. And there are rules and an order to how that unfolds as well. It's still not a free-for-all, you know?
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. I'm just looking at my clock, and I see that our time is up for today. I could go on and on and want to, if at all possible. Any chance you could come back and join us for more conversation next week?
Sure, I'd love to.
That was easy. Generally, I have to beg. And thank you for sparing me that. Could you give us your website address and walk us around a little bit? Tell us where we can find your books so that we can spend some time with you in the interim week.
Sure. My website is just katefrank.com. And there are different pages on there. You know, I have the new book where you can click through to buy that.
Cool.
I have some of my articles online in PDF versions and reviews of my first books, things like that. So, and people can also email me from the site.
Very cool. Very cool. So until next week, we'll be visiting you in cyberspace.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate. See ya.
Thanks. Bye.
What a terrific show. Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Tune in next week at this time for part two of my chat with Katherine Frank and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's Stockroom.
You the best he-bitch in my man stable. If I had two more manginas like you, I'd be a millionaire.
I'm flattered, I'm sure. Listen up, you guys. If your sex life needs a little sprucing up, and whose doesn't, I want you to mosey on over to my online sex emporium and pick out something really naughty for yourself, or the other pervs in your life. I mean, if you can't find what you're looking for in my stockroom, you'd better call off the search right away. Dr. Dick has put together a dazzling array of products that will liven up even the most ho-hum sex life. Not sure what to buy? Take a look at my sex toy review site, DrDickSexToyReviews.com. It's chock full of swell gift-giving ideas.
Look for the Dr. Dick Stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site, and remember, a portion of every sale comes back to us as support for these shows. How great is that? Okay, until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.